Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from The James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, pulls it apart and weaves the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Anna Staver. When it comes to redistricting, everyone says they want fair maps. Maps for our congressional districts and state lawmakers that accurately reflect who we are as Ohioans.
These congressional districts in Ohio made Ohio famous. However, they were unfair and ruthless. They denied citizens an opportunity of fair representation. American democracy is based on the principle that government should be responsive and accountable to the citizens.
But here's the catch. What does fair mean when it comes to map making? One person's fair map is another person's gerrymandered district. Is fairness just in the eye of the beholder? Or are there nonpartisan, scientific, measurable ways of evaluating gerrymandering? These aren't easy questions to answer, but we're going to try to do it this hour. Learn how we draw fair maps. We begin with WOSU reporter George Shilcock, who went to a Columbus Kroger with some printed out maps and a question. Are these districts gerrymandered?
So I wanted to show people the second map, the other one today, because it might surprise you to learn I'm at this Kroger because here's where Joyce Beatty lives, right around, right up there in like a condo up there.
Okay.
She's the Democratic representative for most of Columbus.
Yeah.
This is where Mike Carey lives, right near Schiller Park.
Oh, of course.
They potentially shop at this same Kroger. They may go to the Parsons Avenue one, but
no,
it is.
Don't.
Yeah. That's fair. It has a reputation.
Yeah.
He's talking with a restaurant consultant named Corey Wendell. He lives close to the Kroger on Sycamore Street where George was at. And George asked him what he thought about those two lawmakers living so close together and representing such different districts.
No, I'm not surprised at all. They probably both have a lot of money, as do a lot of the people that live around here. So I'm not surprised by that at all.
Yeah. Do you think, considering the wider district that Mike Carey represents and the area of Columbus that Joyce Beatty represents, do you think it's fair that they live that close together and they both are representing two very different areas? Like, this goes all the way up to Shelby County,
right?
Rural Shelby County with Sydney. Sydney's over there, I believe.
You know, I don't think that they're really representing the people in the areas in which they live. They're more representing, you know, their donors and the parties that they're members of. So I don't think it really matters where they live in that sense, because I don't think they're thinking about the people that live directly around them. I think it's gone much further beyond that. So, yeah.
Joyce Beatty's district is what insiders call a D38, which means that the district votes 38% more blue than the country. Mike Carey is an R12. Neither are what we would call competitive. They're safe seats, and they're part of a national trend. In our last election, Fair Vote calculated that 5 out of every 6 U.S. House seats was won by 10 points or more. Politically speaking, that's a blowout. Just 36 seats. 36 seats out of 435 in the U.S. House were close, meaning they were within 5 points on election night. That's down from 2018 when we had 44. But is that proof of gerrymandering? Is it evidence that our increasingly partisan districts are getting that way because we're doing it on purpose? We're doing it to benefit one political party or the other.
Untangled is a good word to use because we have to detangle two competing factors here.
That's Dave Wasserman. He's a senior editor and election analyst for the Cook Political Report. He's also one of our nation's top election forecasters.
There's the tendency of like-minded voters to cluster near each other on the map over time. And then there's redistricting and the ways in which gerrymandering has grouped voters together to diminish competition. Political scientists debate this back and forth. And yet, my view is that self-sorting accounts for a majority of the decline in competition we've seen over time. But we also have a kind of symbiosis between sorting and redistricting that produces the lack of competition we see. To the extent more voters are clustered together on the map, the easier it is for politicians and partisan actors who control the redistricting process to create heavily red or heavily blue districts. If you were to imagine a state where every precinct was 50-50 between the parties, it would be impossible to manipulate the boundaries in a way that gave one party an advantage in any district. But now imagine a state where all precincts are 70-30 or 80-20 in one direction or the other. Then it's easier to do what's called cracking and packing. And if you're a party trying to maximize your advantage, you want to pack the opposing party's voters in as few districts as possible. And you want to, in some cases, crack areas of concentrated support for your opponent's parties to dilute their voting strength in order to maximize the number of districts you're going to win.
So it's basically, if we all lived in politically and racially diverse neighborhoods, it would be harder to gerrymander.
That's right. And in fact, the sorting that we've seen over time, where we have heavily blue urban and suburban areas and college towns and heavily red rural areas and exurban parts of states, the easier it is to basically sort people who have pre-sorted themselves.
Fair districts aren't all about competitiveness, though. They're also about creating compact districts along natural boundaries that keep communities together. But how do we define community?
This is what's so hard for reformers who are trying to add some fairness to the redistricting process. It's very tough to define what a community of interest is, and it's difficult to establish a bright line standard for how to treat all communities equitably when you're dividing a state into a finite number of districts. And there are arguments that have been made by both Republicans and Democrats who are seeking to draw districts that favor them but look really bad on a map to say, well, we need districts that take a little bit of urban Ohio, for example, and combine it with a lot of rural Ohio so that our members of Congress can get a taste of everyone's points of view. Or for Democrats drawing a map in Illinois, for example, that stretches a district from the outskirts of St. Louis to Champaign-Urbana, their rationale was linking college towns and communities that are driven by higher education, when in fact, their primary motivation is to draw a district that's going to favor Democrats.
This is one of those challenges where it's competing interests. Like, if a school district crosses a river, is it more important to keep the school district together or to use the river as one of those natural boundary lines?
Yeah, and one of the elements that gets lost here is the extent to which natural boundaries and pre-existing governmental boundaries, such as counties and townships and cities, could be used as building blocks for districts. Oftentimes, district lines rip through those to try and crack and pack voters. And if this were a simple bureaucratic function, as it is in many other first-past-the-post systems around the world, then we wouldn't be talking about the kind of litigation that proceeds well into every decade after the census to adjudicate what constitutes a fair map or a gerrymander.
Compactness and competitiveness can also be mutually exclusive. So you can have requirements in state constitutions that essentially contradict each other. As someone who studies this, how do map makers across the country decide which part of their constitution to prioritize?
It's a great question. And states have different criteria. We have a patchwork of redistricting processes across our 50 states. And some criteria can conflict with others. For example, the Voting Rights Act and protecting minority voting rights in some cases means grouping voters of certain races or ethnicities together who may live in geographically far apart places. It may necessitate drawing lines that don't conform with those county boundaries or metro areas in a defined way. But we also see a number of states that in their bipartisan or nonpartisan redistricting commission criteria prioritize compactness. There are only a handful of states that prioritize competitiveness in the process. Arizona is one of them. Colorado is another. But competitiveness seems to be lower on the scale of what states are prioritizing.
We're going to talk about Arizona later on in this series because, yeah, when you prioritize competitiveness, you do get some crazy looking maps, some maps that look gerrymandered.
That's true. And in Arizona, in 2011, the 5-member redistricting commission adopted a map that its stated goal was to maximize the number of competitive seats. And Republicans cried foul because in order to achieve that in certain parts of the state, compactness had to go out the window. And the commission said, hey, we're following the criteria that voters approved. And Republicans in the state went so far as to impeach the redistricting chair because they believed she was adopting a Democratic gerrymander.
It's a crazy story, and I'm really looking forward to sharing it with all of our listeners. But one of the challenges in Arizona, and it's a challenge everywhere, is the Voting Rights Act. This idea that you need to create majority-minority districts or that you can't break apart minorities to dilute their votes. One of the things about racial gerrymandering, though, is to adhere to the Voting Rights Act, it does kind of seem like it's a requirement to pack people into a district.
That is true. And there's something called the Jingles test that the Supreme Court issued in the late 80s. It interpreted the Voting Rights Act to mean that if a certain minority group demonstrated that there was racially polarized voting and that they were sufficiently geographically compact and politically cohesive enough to form a majority of voters in a single district, then that district should be drawn. But the problem is we don't have a standard definition in this country of what's compact and what's not. It's in the eye of the beholder. And this is the same issue that's bedeviled challengers of gerrymandered maps passed by state legislatures and in some cases politician-appointed commissions that say their maps are fair, but in reality are grossly advantaging one party.
It's also a really interesting conversation to me between Republicans and Democrats because you think Democrats support the Voting Rights Act, but Republicans seem to really enjoy it when it comes to redistricting because it almost seems like an excuse to pack all these Democratic voters into these small districts.
That's true. And in fact, after 1992, when the Voting Rights Act proliferated the number of majority-minority districts, including a lot of new Black-majority districts in the South, it effectively whitewashed surrounding districts and made them more winnable for Republicans. And in 1994, we saw Republicans win a really large number of seats in the South, in part because so many Democratic voters who were African American had been segmented into majority minority seats.
I think this is why redistricting is so complicated at every turn, because that law, the Voting Rights Act and the implementation of it, also resulted in an increase in Black legislators. Like some of the leaders that we see in Congress now might not have been elected in the first place.
That's true. And at the same time, it also has limited the upward mobility, I believe, of many non-white members of Congress who represent majority-minority seats because, well, number one, there aren't surrounding seats in which particularly Democrats of color can be competitive. But also, if you're representing a district that is 60% Black or 70% Hispanic, you aren't gaining the exposure to other voters in parts of your state that might be valuable to build familiarity with if you want to win a statewide election.
One of the criteria that is up on the table for voters here in Ohio is proportionality. So the new amendment that we're going to be voting on in November has a number of provisions, but one of them is this idea that Democrats and Republicans should get seats or have districts that roughly lean one way or the other based on the outcome of our state elections over the course of a decade. This is such a controversial idea because I hear so much from the opponents that this is just doing away with our district system, that they're trying to backdoor us towards like European proportional representation.
It's a debate that is really complicated because if your goal is for districts to be proportional to the partisan lean of your state, well, that's not always possible. Take the state of Massachusetts, for example, which has 9 congressional districts, and Democrats currently represent all 9 of the seats. Well, proportionally, if you're going by the statewide breakdown, Republicans ought to have 3 of the 9 districts. But it's impossible, given Massachusetts's political geography, to draw even one district that leans Republican because the state's towns, except for a few, all are firmly Democratic. Now, in a state like Ohio, things are a bit different. There are enough pockets of Democratic strength that you can draw a map that would favor Democrats in 6 or 7 of the state's 15 districts. And yet doing so requires making some conscious choices that would favor Democrats. For example, drawing one Democratic seat in the southern part of Franklin County, and then one that takes the northern Columbus suburbs and Delaware County and creates a second Democratic district. Well, Republicans would consider that to be a Democratic gerrymander, even if it produced something closer to a proportional outcome. That's why you've seen Republicans in Ohio argue that the maps that they've passed, whether it's the legislature map that got struck down or the commission map that got struck down, create more competitive districts where either party has a good chance of winning. Of course, those competitive districts are the ones where Democrats are now on defense.
Competitiveness is such a complicated word because all these terms really mean different things to different people. So is a district that is 5 points, 10 points competitive? Is it a competitive district that proportionally leans Democrat if it's 49-51, but then if all the Republican districts are 55-45, is that a gerrymandered map?
There's also the question of what data set are you using here when you're talking about a district being 51-49 one way or 55-45? Well, Republicans in the most recent round of redistricting were arguing that some of the districts they drew leaned to Democrats because Sherrod Brown had carried them in 2018 by a large margin. But what they aren't noting is that that was an atypical performance for a Democrat in this era. Sherrod Brown won re-election by a comfortable margin in a very favorable year for Democrats. And if you look at the presidential data, well, Donald Trump carried the 9th district currently held by Marcy Kaptur, and that is a reasonable Republican pickup opportunity this year. So there's no doubt in my mind that the map in Ohio favors Republicans more than a neutrally drawn map would. The difficulty from a reform perspective is it's very difficult to establish a set of rules that establishes how far is too far when it comes to an acceptable advantage for either party, or should the map, such as in the rules in California, be drawn without regard to partisan data at all?
Dave raises a good question. What we prioritize is kind of what we gerrymander. Do we value competitiveness, compactness, proportionality? And how do we know when we've taken it too far? We're going to answer those questions when Untangled continues, right here on 89.7 NPR News. Hi, this is Anna, the host of Untangled here at WOSU, and I have a quick favor to ask. If you're enjoying the show, would you mind leaving us a rating and review in Apple, Spotify, or wherever you're listening? Ratings tell the algorithm that our show should be shared with other people, and I would appreciate your help getting the word out. You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're untangling redistricting in Ohio, and today we're asking the deceptively simple question, how do you draw fair maps? The snake on the lake, the duck district, the upside-down praying mantis, These are nicknames for districts that look more like Rorschach tests than congressional boundaries. Districts that look gerrymandering when you see them. But funny looking isn't a legal standard. Cities have meandering shapes because of natural boundaries or annexations. If you're going to say this weird shape was drawn for partisan gain, you need a way of proving it. That's where Professor Samuel Wong comes in. He's a neuroscientist, the director of Princeton's gerrymandering project, and the creator of a math test for partisan mapmaking. Professor Wong, I want to begin by defining the categories you lay out for this test. You say courts should evaluate whether maps create unequal opportunities and durable outcomes. What do these terms mean?
Well, unequal opportunities means, for example, if one side has guaranteed wins and the other side can never break in, if that happens out of proportion by artful drawing, then that would be one way in which we could imagine that a skew is in place. As far as durable opportunities go, you've had some excellent people on this program before where it's pointed out that you can kind of tell how a district that is drawn hypothetically could perform in the future by looking at how the people in that district have voted in the past. And so it's possible to predict with modern computer technology and also precinct by precinct data whether a precinct will be reliable in the future. And if the margin in that district is predicted to be more than 7 points for either the Democrat or the Republican, then that would be a pretty durable district that would be pretty guaranteed for the next 10 years. And so nerds who work with maps are able to do these things and figure them out with a lot of reliability.
Yeah, you also write about this principle of partisan symmetry. Why is this the golden rule of redistricting?
Well, partisan symmetry is a nice concept because it doesn't really require a lot of math. It's more like the principle I think any child knows of I cut, you choose. The principle namely being that if you draw a map, it should not give undue favor to one party or the other. So for example, if a map is drawn to give favor to, say, Democrats over Republicans or Republicans over Democrats, if they were to switch vote shares, if instead of 55-45 being for my party, if you got 55-45 over me, then in theory, we should be able to switch how many seats we have. And that principle of symmetry is just a simple measure of fairness that I think a kid could understand.
So if you were to look at a place like Ohio, when Obama won the state of Ohio in 2012, Republicans won 10 of, a majority of our seats. But then when Trump won in 2016, Republicans still won the same number of congressional seats. So no matter who was winning the state in terms of vote share, we were getting the same result in our congressional districts. Is that kind of what you mean when it comes to partisan symmetry or the lack thereof?
Kind of. Ohio used to be a swing state. Now it leans Republican in most circumstances for the presidential election, but not always for other elections. I mean, you have a highly competitive Senate race this year that could go either way. And I would say that the idea of symmetry would be, hypothetically, if things swing the other way at a statewide level, then could it be that the other party would be able to have at least the chance of getting a majority? And that fighting chance to be able to get a majority if you get more of the votes isn't always observed. When legislators draw their own districts, when they draw their own maps, they often will insulate themselves against that that outcome by skewing the maps to prevent it from ever happening.
You also talk a little bit about vote shares, percentage of vote cast, and shares won in states. You've given some examples before of Pennsylvania in 2012. So Democrats won a little more than 50% of all votes cast in Pennsylvania in 2012. But Republicans there won 72% of the state House seats. So what is that indicative of when the popular vote is wildly divergent from the legislative outcome?
Well, redistricting is this crazy activity where, in principle, what we're supposed to do these days is trade off all the interests, whether they be partisan or racial fairness or representing, say, farming communities or urban communities or suburban communities. And normally there's a give and take. And when you have a situation like what happened in Pennsylvania, where a close to 50-50 vote led to a 72-28 outcome, what that tells you is that in all likelihood, what happened there was that one criterion, partisan advantage, was privileged over all other possible criteria that you could apply. And the difficulty is coming up with a process in which those different interests get balanced. And, you know, the simple yardstick of that you've come up with is one way of telling that one thing got prioritized over everything else.
And it's not just Republicans who do this. You can see this in the state of Maryland and how their legislative outcomes work.
That's right. So places like, you know, Ohio in the past, Pennsylvania in the past, have done it on the Republican side. And you can see it on the Democratic side in Illinois, in Maryland, and in other states. And so anytime one party is in charge, as has effectively been the case in some states that we could name, that one party is unfettered and can run loose and just engage in self-dealing.
So it's not really one side or the other. It's more access to power is hard to turn down.
That's right. So when legislators get into office and they get into control of a process and they don't have to take into account the other party, there's just this natural temptation to say, okay, you know what? We're going to deal ourselves into power. And that is an extremely difficult problem. And it's kind of funny that redistricting is this weird weak point in our democracy, where it's one of the points at which legislators get to draw their own playing field, which is kind of amazing. It's if nobody would have designed this on purpose had they known in advance about partisanship and parties and the kinds of flaws that we have over the last few decades.
These outcomes that we've been talking about, like where you win 50% of the vote but 70% of the seats, they create something that you call an efficiency gap, which means some politicians win with many more votes than they need. How does one calculate an efficiency gap, and why would that be used to, say, legal evidence of gerrymandering?
Well, the efficiency gap is a clever measure come up that's been formulated by Nick Stephanopoulos at the Harvard Law School and Eric McGee, who teaches in Kansas. And what they came up with was a formula that captures the idea that there's a right amount of seats that comes with a certain amount of vote, and that if you drew maps at random, I mean, this isn't really the way they put it, but if you draw maps at random, then there's a certain fraction of the seats that you might expect to get normally. And they get into it with this concept that they devise called wasted votes, which approximates the idea that some votes just aren't going to be well used because, in fact, we bunch up in cities, we bunch up in rural areas, and consequently, there's a winner's bonus. And so the efficiency gap is one of three or four different yardsticks that redistricting experts have come up with as a way of just very quickly telling whether a map has gotten out of whack, just like in the same way that if you're a carpenter building a table, you put a level on it to make sure that it's okay. You get a T-square to make sure it's right angled. And so there are just these tools that people use in the service of commissions and in the service of courts and redistrictors to tell them when something's out of whack.
So we have all of these tools, but some lopsided districts are simply inevitable. Columbus is a very blue city. You couldn't draw competitive districts for the city of Columbus unless you spiraled several of them out from the center. So there always are going to be heavily Republican or heavily Democratic districts, especially in a state like Ohio, right?
Yeah, that's right. So you can imagine different ways to distribute that. So that one problem is that current law in Ohio takes a quite strict approach to these things, wanting to make sure that, for instance, a large city like Columbus does not get split. But then when you have a trade-off between doing that and also making sure that the overall map is relatively fair to both parties, actually fair being defined in the law currently as proportional, and that's the current Ohio law, then you have to start making some trade-offs. And you have to make a decision, well, how would we hypothetically split Columbus? Could we find a way to do it that didn't do too much damage to the representational interests of people in Columbus or communities surrounding Columbus?
If Columbus itself was a congressional district, just all by itself, people would look at the map and probably think it's a gerrymandered district. We have all these strange spiraling arms that come off the city, and that's just annexation. So sometimes even just the way cities and communities develop can look weird.
Yeah, that's right. We think of city boundaries as being a natural way to define districts, at least we in the redistricting community. But if you look very closely, cities make decisions about who to annex. Like, gosh, you know, I kind of like that kind of neighbor. I wouldn't like that kind of neighbor. I'd like you in my tax base. I wouldn't like you in my tax base. And as a result, you get some strange, strange things. Like I know Wisconsin a little bit better than I know Ohio, but in any state, there are going to be incorporations that take in little islands that don't even join the city. Like you end up with this archipelago of little blocks that where you have to leave the city. If you're going from one part of the city to another, you might actually have to leave the city in order to go to another part of the city, which is a kind of zany, but it is the way that city boundaries are drawn these days.
Yeah, so just looking at a map of Columbus, I'm like, it looks kind of like an amoeba. So I guess maybe it would be the amoeba district if it was just the city of Columbus.
Yes, and you know, people in Columbus in one of those pseudopods of the amoeba might be a little bit surprised to find out that their neighbors are not in the city.
You know, we're talking about all these different standards, but the U.S. federal government, or at least the U.S. Supreme Court, has said none of these are good enough to declare a ban on partisan gerrymandering. So where do we go from here at the federal level?
Yeah, the Supreme Court made me kind of sad because a constitutional law professor and I wrote a brief pointing out that some of these measures are pretty simple. And then Chief Justice John Roberts wrote that, in fact, these are simple mathematical measures. But the math is not the point. The point is the Constitution. And I will paraphrase him since I'm no legal scholar. But he said, look, we're just going to step back. It's not justiciable, meaning it's not our job to take care of it. So even Chief Justice Roberts admitted that some of the math is not that complicated. It's just that they didn't want to go there. And so what that leaves is state processes like Ohio's initiative process to decide whether to go there. And that's something that's obviously a live topic this year.
So essentially all of these different ideas, from wasted votes to all of the to efficiency gaps to durable outcomes, these are all tests that we could use in an Ohio Supreme Court to say this map is gerrymandered or this map is not.
That's right. At this point, there's quite a nice toolbox available to any court, including the Ohio Supreme Court, that could do this. And then and one could also, of course, put those tools in the hands of a commission. So if you take a commission, which is, you know, kind of like a jury, the jury comes together, the experts assist the jury. I would be someone who would be an assistant to the jury, hypothetically, someday, who could say. But anyway, but the point being, but there are dozens of people available who are talented who could do this, who could say, you know what, here's how you use the tools. And so whether it be a court or a commission or, you know, any committee, the assistants can help them navigate through these tests.
Another way that I find fascinating that's really cropped up in the last couple of years is analyzing multiple maps, asking almost the computer modeling system to make me 100 different versions and then looking at averages. And it's something we couldn't do, say, 20 or even 30 years ago.
100, please.
many, many more than 100.
Come on, like, this is like the penny ante. It used to be 10 years ago, 15 years ago, 100 was considered pretty good. It is now possible at the touch of a button to basically simulate a million maps. And so but one way you can evaluate a map is to draw a million maps at random and say, okay, what do these million random maps tell you? And so that is certainly possible these days. It's within the reach of desktop computing. Another way is to, I mean, this is going to be the opposite, but redistricting nerds, of which there are surprisingly many, there are all kinds of people all over the country who just love drawing hypothetical maps. It's kind of like role play. And so if you go to a website like Dave's Redistricting app, there are people who do things like say, oh, could I draw a map that's a super duper gerrymander? Or, oh, could I draw a map that's super duper fair? And it turns out that all these people just like, there's like swarms of geeks everywhere who have just figured all this out. And so it's become this highly democratized activity.
I love that. Do you think we'll ever see a day where artificial intelligence will take over our map making?
I think that that is hard to imagine because the process has to be given up voluntarily by either voters or by legislators. And it's one thing to take the power away from legislators and put it to voters, but really to give it to an AI? I mean, I do think that an AI could be assistive. So I think that the technical nerd could possibly be supplanted. You can imagine that a committee would say, well, I'd like to have something that's, you know, proportional and pretty competitive and not too crazy shapes. Why don't you go and try drawing me a map that does that? And so you can imagine getting an AI to, you know, kind of beep and boop and come up with something that that met all those. But, you know, ultimately, I don't know, like, you need people to decide whether to break up Shaker Heights or not, or whatever. I mean, there's just things that you really need people to do to sit around and argue about.
That was Princeton Professor Samuel Wong. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're deep diving into proportionality, untangling how it might play out if the proposed amendment becomes law here in Ohio. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Untangled. I'm your host, Anna Staver. President John Adams believed our system of representative democracy would produce, quote, an exact portrait in miniature of the people at large. Our districts would be microcosms of our state, and the U.S. House would reflect the diversity of our country. It's a really nice idea, but it hasn't worked out that way in practice. The group trying to change how Ohio draws its districts this November says we can get back to that through proportionality, which means making the districts lean blue or red in proportion to how Ohioans vote in statewide elections. In 2024, that would give Republicans a 55% advantage in our state House districts instead of the 70% they currently hold. Sounds like a solid plan, right? Well, Governor Mike DeWine thinks Ohioans might dislike proportionality when they see the shapes it creates.
The things that we normally associate with good government, keeping cities together, if possible, keeping villages together, townships together, counties together, whenever you can, keeping communities, so-called communities of interest. Democrats and Republicans both have used those terms. Those are considered good things. But what this amendment does is it says none of those are as important and are subservient, actually, to proportionality. And for our listeners, proportionality is defined in this amendment very, very simply. You go back for the last few years and you average all the statewide races and you come up with Republicans won, I'm making this up because I don't know the exact number, but let's say 55% of the vote for governor and all the other offices and Democrats 45. So then, and here's where I think the problem is, the map maker, whoever it is, the map maker is instructed, you have to have 55% of these districts that are Republican-leaning districts. You have to have 45% that are Democrat-leaning districts. And all the other things that we like, all these things are subservient. And so the only thing that in the end is going to matter is proportionality. And how do we know that? We know it because we've been through it with these districts. And we've seen what the Democrats proposed to try to get that number during the last series of hearings. We saw what an independent group, Dave's Redistricting West, I think it's called, what they came up with. And they were crazy districts. And they were crazy districts, not because something was wrong with the map draws. They're crazy districts because they all were trying to get to proportionality. And the way we live in Ohio, the way people are Democrats are bunched a great deal in the cities. Republicans are certainly spread out all over the rural areas. Just because of the way most states are, and certainly Ohio is, if you hit proportionality, which this amendment tells you you have to do, you're going to break up townships. You're going to blow up small counties even. And it's going to be a district that looks like some dragon. Or some horror show. So we know that because we have seen that. And these are what the Democrats put forward. This is what the good government group put forward. So it mandates that.
Governor DeWine likes how Iowa draws its districts, a method we're going to learn more about next week. But first, I want to bring in Common Cause's director of redistricting. His name is Dan Vicuña, and he helped draft November's amendment. Dan, what do you make of the governor's concerns about proportionality and the maps it will create?
Well, hearing the governor's argument, and thank you for having me, by the way, hearing the governor's argument reminds me of how jealously politicians guard this power to manipulate their district, manipulate their own districts, manipulate districts in which they have a partisan interest in the process. And the governor was part of a group of politicians who in the last cycle had maps struck down by the Ohio Supreme Court in a bipartisan vote over and over again because they violated rules intended to ensure fairness in the process. So they were a partisan manipulation of Ohio's districts, in both congressional districts and state legislative districts. And that's why Ohioans are demanding a change and want a better way and are interested in implementing an independent redistricting commission, which has worked in red states, blue states, and cities and counties across the country to ensure that redistricting is a fairer, more transparent, and less partisan process driven primarily by community input.
So issue one, which we're going to vote on in November, says that maps can deviate from proportionality if it's mathematically impossible to hit the state's voting preferences. What does that mean?
Yeah, well, you know, what that means, you know, let's look at how the process is really supposed to work under this amendment. What really drives the drawing of districts in Ohio, if Ohioans pass this amendment in November, is going to be community feedback. You know, this is designed to create a 15-person board, Democrats, Republicans, and independents from all walks of life who don't have an axe to grind politically, who don't have a personal stake in the drawing of districts. They're required to go around the state. Every region of the state is what the constitutional amendment mandates at several different points in the drawing of districts before drafts, after drafts, to get community feedback. And so that's what primarily drives the drawing of districts. Now we have this proportionality standard as some guardrails, some protections against what's been a partisan manipulation of the maps going back decades. And in particular, the most egregious example that the governor helped to lead in the last cycle. Again, maps being struck down over and over by the state Supreme Court. And so this proportionality standard takes a look at, you know, how have Ohioans generally voted over the last 6 years in statewide elections. And let's make sure that the maps that are going to be primarily driven by community feedback largely stay within the bounds of how Ohioans are actually voting and make sure that there's no huge advantage to one party or the other. And that's what this proportionality standard is. And it has some flexibility, obviously, to allow understanding that, you're not going to be able to find an exact mathematical match. It's just to make sure that these districts aren't drawn to advantage one party or the other the way they've been drawn in the past by elected officials in a way to partisan gerrymander them, to protect incumbents so they don't have to go out and campaign for a re-election. So this is a reform that's worked all around the country, and we're looking forward to helping to improve democracy in Ohio with it.
I should also note that our current system of redistricting with our current commission does require them to try and match our statewide voting preferences. So we have a little bit of proportionality requirements in the current system.
That's right. Yeah. And this is largely a way to sort of drill down on how to accomplish that. You know, it looks at a certain number of elections and it specifies what the period is for looking at those elections to, again, just figure out what some outer guardrails are to make sure that these maps don't provide an advantage to one party or the other.
One big change from the way we draw maps now is that this amendment wouldn't restrict how many times map makers can split cities, counties, or townships. Is there any fear that that's opening the door to gerrymandering? Why eliminate that requirement?
So what we do in this amendment is we do say that if the public believes that keeping their city, keeping their county together is important, and they testify to that effect, that's something that map makers should pay attention to. So we do actually protect county city boundaries if the community thinks that makes the most sense for where they live. Sometimes communities of interest, they do cross city and county boundaries. So we think it's important to leave some flexibility there. But, you know, the splitting of jurisdictions, localities, really happens when you see a manipulated process by politicians. They're ensuring their own reelection. They're ensuring that they slice and dice communities for partisan advantage. You really don't see that kind of abuse when it's nonpartisan actors from all walks of life, Democrats, Republicans, and independents, who are doing this for the purpose of trying to make to do right by a state's community. So, we think that's an important protection with some flexibility. So it is there still.
Governor DeWine also says that issue one is an end run around the system of representative democracy, essentially that proportionality is how certain European governments do it, where, you know, you vote for one party or the other and there's a slate. And so, you know, if it's 100 lawmakers in a body and it's 55-45, you get 55 Republicans and 45 Democrats, but you're not voting for a single representative. Now, that's not what this amendment proposes, but what do you make of the idea that this is an end run to get us to a proportional system like that?
I mean, it's just false. There's no way around it. It's always fascinating to me to hear elected officials, talk about how you sort of defend their right to draw districts and say that they're elected representatives, that they should do it. You know, this partisan gerrymandering is designed very specifically to make it more difficult for the public, Ohioans, to hold politicians accountable for their actions on election day. And so the idea that they should be drawing their own districts to protect their jobs, to make it harder for the voters of a jurisdiction to vote them out of office, to throw the bums out when justified, is always kind of a ridiculous notion to hear that from politicians, to defend their own power to draw districts is silly. This amendment would allow voters to hold them accountable, to draw districts based on community feedback, and to not protect politicians' jobs, to make them accountable to voters.
Let's move on to proportionality in the Voting Rights Act. The Citizen Commission in Michigan got in a little bit of trouble for drawing districts that violated federal law. DeWine says that's a side effect of proportionality.
I think the odds are that you're going to have fewer African-American representation in the legislature and in Congress. I think that's just a fact, because what you to get to the numbers that they're talking about, you have to take the cities where there's the most concentration of Democrat voters, and you have to cut up like a pie, and you have to run each slice out into the country, but keeping enough so that you end up with a Democrat district. Look, it's only speculation. I don't think anybody knows for sure, but I think that's a concern.
Dan, how do you make sure that proportionality doesn't run afoul of the Voting Rights Act?
Well, the governor doesn't know for sure. I know for sure. We place a premium on protections under the Voting Rights Act and federal laws that defend against racial gerrymandering, racial discrimination, and redistricting. Voting Rights Act still applies. And this is simply not what proportionality is supposed to be. Proportionality is about setting outward guardrails about the map overall to make sure it does not advantage one party over the other. There's no mandate to draw the kind of silly districts that the governor's talking about, and quite frankly, that he was a part of in the last cycle. So it's just wrong.
And if you do make a mistake, obviously what happened in Michigan, they sent them back. They made them redraw them anyway.
That's right. And which is a far contrast from how it went in Ohio and other places where elected officials are in charge. In Michigan, when courts said you have to make some adjustments to better ensure Black representation, the commission went to parts of the state that were particularly impacted, got community feedback, changed the maps, and got it done in one redraw. They fixed it, which is the way we've seen citizen commissions work across the country, which is that they're trying to do right by communities. They're making a good faith effort to do the best they can to represent everyone well. And when they make a mistake, they fix it right away. Unlike politicians, say in Ohio, which had their maps sent back 7 times, one set of maps and twice on the other for congressional and state legislative, obviously making no good faith effort to improve how they drew maps, to do right by communities, simply trying to protect their jobs. So that's why elected officials cannot be trusted with this power.
I want to ask about a quirk of proportionality, because you could make districts that say are 51-49 Democrat, and then you could draw the opposite districts 55-45 Republican. And you could hit proportionality in terms of which way they lean. But if all the Republican seats are safe and all the Democratic leaning districts are, a hair's breadth away of flipping, does that meet the spirit of the law.
I think that's the kind of mathematical trickery that you only see politicians engage in the redistricting process. Generally, when you have, citizen commissions, which you see again in places like Michigan, Colorado, California, and cities like Austin, Texas, Syracuse, New York, nonpartisan actors that are trying to put communities first, you just don't see that kind of manipulation. They really are, despite whatever sort of political preferences they may have in the voting booth, they've been specifically screened to not have a personal stake in how these particular districts are drawn, to not for it not to be about their jobs. And they really do the best they can to hear community feedback and draw districts that are based on that feedback. So you really just don't see that kind of manipulation the way that you do when politicians are in charge.
That was Dan Vicuña from Common Cause. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Next week, we're untangling how other states, like the ones Dan mentioned, do redistricting, learning how mapmaking has played out in places that already have these citizen commissions. Until then, thanks for listening to Untangled, right here on 89.7 NPR News.
You know, every day on Up First, NPR's Golden Globe-nominated morning news podcast, we bring you three essential stories. At the heart of each story are questions. What really happened? What really mattered? What happens next? At NPR, we stand for your right to be curious and to follow the facts. Follow Up First wherever you get your podcasts and start your day knowing what matters and why.